Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Chicago-born author Alex Poppy just published her first novel. It's called Moxie. It comes from a short story that Poppy wrote for her collection Girl World. The novel follows the main character, Jax. Jax is a former supermodel who, after a motorcycle bombing in Morocco, has her face permanently disfigured. Jax has to learn how to live her life now that beauty is not her calling card. The novel also takes on issues surrounding social justice and immigration. Poppy used her own experiences in the fashion industry to help with the story, as well as her life as an actor and an educator. Currently, the Lombard-born writer is teaching abroad. She is living in northern Iraq, teaching at American University of Iraq. She's back for a couple days, and we're excited to have Alex Poppy in studio tonight on Extension 720. Alex, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Justin. I'm really happy to be here.
So let's get right to it. This is amazing. The ability for a writer to start with a short story and move that into a novel. How difficult is it to do that?
I can't speak for other writers because I don't know how they work, but I never know what the story is going to be. I'm not a writer that writes a ton and goes back and edits a ton. I go beat by beat and I edit every day. So the story kind of unfolded itself to me. I didn't really know the direction I wanted to take it in. There were two stories in that first collection I thought I would expand. Mm-hmm. I have a rape in the military story in that first collection, and I wanted to expand that, but I didn't know what that story was about yet. So then I revisited Jax because I could really hear her. I mean, it's so voice driven. I don't think really all that much happens in the book, but it's very voice driven, and I could hear her talking, and so I let her talk to me, and that's what followed. And then as I got interested in things, they found themselves in the story. So the Kalief Browder story was because I was listening to Democracy Now. And the New Yorker had done a lot of great reporting on it. The urbexing was something I saw in the New York Times, and I thought, wow, that's so cool. I got to put it in. Immigration, obviously. Right. I was hunting around on the Half Kings website, and I saw the photography exhibit online. And you know, my dad's an immigrant, and that resonated, so that became part of it.
As a writer, is that where you draw inspiration from, being an informed citizen, but also someone who is just paying attention to the world around you and the issues around you? You're able to look at those stories, those factual stories, and be able to make fiction out of them?
Yeah. I had a short story that started with a photograph I saw on Facebook of a friend of mine, a great friend of mine, when he was super young. And then I had read this article again in the Times about biogenetic engineering and how wealthier couples were purchasing the qualities they wanted in their children. And I thought, whoa, that's strange.
That's
a story. I started
to
do a lot research, and it became my story, Family Matter.
Back to the idea of writing a short story and then choosing to expand that story. What are the qualities you're looking for? You said it was easy for you to expand Jax's character or Jax's story. Was it because the character was more developed than others? Because you resonated more with the character? What was it about this particular story that said, this is going to be my first novel?
It was the voice. I have to hear the character. I have to hear the narrator. And if I can't hear it, it's very hard for me to write. I'm working on a coming-of-age novel where I use flamenco as an extended metaphor, and it's very lyrical. And I purposely am trying not to have this brash, aggressive, funny narrative voice because that's been a lot of my first two books. And as a result, I can't quite hear this narrator all the time, and it's a bit more difficult to write. So I could definitely hear the voice, mm-hmm. and I just let the voice speak to me.
Talk about Jax. This character is very nuanced. And to start the novel in a way that you almost are coming from a place of depression. Depression might not be the right word, but just she's very dark in the way that she's approaching her life, and then it unfolds what happened to her, and you can understand why. But talk about this character. What do we need to know about Jax?
I like the descriptions of her being profane and poetic. I think they're both equally accurate. To me, I deliberately set out to craft a character that was unlikable. I wanted that challenge to see if I could make the audience and the reader root for this character and stay with them through the length of the novel. Then the qualities I gave her are the qualities we more often ascribe to men and that we give permission to men to have. Sexual promiscuity and just overall kind of bad behavior. And I wanted to make the point that it's not engendered, right? There's behavior that both genders equally employ or exhibit. But our society sort of excuses it, I believe, more with men than they do with women. So I wanted to give those qualities to a female. I've always been fascinated with this idea. I started as a financial analyst. So growing up, I was not very attractive. I grew up in, you know, city of Chicago, outside Chicago, where the ideal of beauty was blonde, blue-eyed, small-featured, and, you know, I have very Italian features. So I grew up you know, basically being told that I wasn't attractive, but I was really smart. And then I became an actor, and that whole industry is so looks focused. Mm-hmm. And then I, you know, worked for a designer, could see what was happening with the models. And I thought, well, what happens to women who the only way they've known themselves is from what they look like? That's all their identity is anchored in. And then I feel like American culture isn't very kind to women in my demographic. So over 50, people who have consciously not married or had children, the society doesn't really know what to do with us or where to put us. Whereas other cultures, sometimes women are more included in the fabric of society at all ages. Sometimes they're entirely discluded. But for me, I wanted to explore what that's like, and I wanted it to be immediate and sudden. Hmm. So that's the accident. That's why her face is half destroyed.
It's really interesting, too, because there is this wrestling with how she thinks people are going to perceive her.
Yeah.
You know, it almost becomes almost the first thought that she has. And almost every time she meets somebody, whether it's somebody that she's interested in or you know, says something to her on the street or anything like that. And there seems to be this preoccupation around beauty. And this, I thought, this beautiful passage about whether or not she was happy when she was a model and she was doing all these things, a swimsuit cover, mm-hmm. or whether she was in a Victoria's Secret ad. She didn't know that she was happy or not. And she looked back fondly on those memories, but she also didn't know if she was happy at that time.
I think part of that is she's confusing convenience with happiness. I also crafted her with a deliberate lack of agency, and I used sentence structure to communicate that. I think the sentence structure works on a subliminal level. I don't think people realize that's what I'm doing. They just notice it. So the first two-thirds of the novel, Jax almost never uses the I. They're all sentence fragments because she doesn't have agency for her actions. And as she comes to terms with the horrible thing that she feels that she's done and sort of has a little bit of a resolution, she starts having her eyes in her sentences and speaks in more complete sentences.
That's interesting.
So I think when she thinks, oh, was I happy? It was more that it was convenient because somebody was telling her what to do. She had a handler always organizing things for her. She didn't have to think.
She didn't have to think about not being a model. I mean, that a lot of it is it obviously seems to be like a metaphor or a story about what a lot of people, when their business is on looks, whether you're an actor or a model or anything like that, and like you said, they sort of phase out in what society considers them to be in that demographic. What do they do with their lives? In this case, it was thrusted upon her because of a bombing, mm-hmm. And a disfigurement to her face. But that's the concept of being, having to figure out what to do next when you were just in it.
John Burnside has this great quote in one of his short stories. The end of the story is the character's like, I must not want anything, so therefore I must be happy. So this absence of desire, does it equal being happy? And I think that happens with our lives. We get into routine and maybe aren't making our choices, but allowing, you know, what you should do. You should get married. You should have a house. You should have children. Those things kind of dictate the way our lives flow. And then we say, well, okay, yeah, I must have had a good life. I must be happy. But has there been agency in any of those choices?
Alex Poppe is my guest. She's the author of the novel Moxie, her first one. She grew up here in Lombard, Illinois, and she's now teaching in Iraq. And I want to talk about that.
Sure.
We'll take a quick break and we'll come back here on Extension 720. So stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest, author Alex Poppe, her first novel, Moxie, is out now. As I mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, you grew up in the area, in Lombard, and mm-hmm. you also now are teaching abroad. I want to get into that because, you know, teaching at a university in Iraq, in northern Iraq, with the kids that you have as well, to think that this is the generation that of Iraqi children who are now, or were part of the invasion.
Yeah.
And that's something I don't think we think about. We think about how years move on, but we don't think about how it affected the people that live there. And I want to ask you about that as someone who has direct involvement with these students and to see what they've had to live through for the last 15 years. What's your takeaway? Do you feel that their story's being told?
I don't really feel like their story is being told. I've written a couple of nonfiction pieces about students who have let me interview them at length. But our population is a majority Kurdish, so their parents have lived through Anfal. I have a lot of Yazidi kids that survived the genocide in Sinjar, which is very recent and very raw. I have kids from Mosul who had to figure out how to survive through ISIS. And I have kids from the south who were 10, 11, 12, 13 during the 2003 invasion and remember what it was like when coalition forces came in through their houses and did those sweeps late at night. And sometimes they were very friendly and they took their gloves off and shook a father's hand. And sometimes they put all the men in the courtyard and beat them. And I'm always amazed when my students just don't categorically hate Americans. I have this kid. He's just amazing. He's from Tikrit. You know, he had two uncles that were in Abu Ghraib. You know, we did that. And he can remember another time where they were coming to search the house and his uncle or cousin's wife was stuffing the gold in her pockets. And one of the coalition forces soldiers was like, "What are you doing? What are you doing?" And he grabbed her in a way that's very offensive for the local culture. And so her husband came running up and they just shot him and killed him in front of everyone. And those are their experiences that they've had and witnessed in very formulative years. And so that they can, that they have the ability to divorce a culture or a people from the foreign policy and the government of a country is remarkable to me.
Right.
That they don't hate Americans, that they don't think we do want to just go in and steal the oil, no matter how many times Trump has said that since his inauguration, is remarkable to me. And it's the only thing that really gives me hope that they will find peace for themselves without it being imposed from a foreign power.
Is it difficult to be in the position you're in as a teacher without that shared experience? To be someone from the Midwest in the United States of America who goes to Northern Iraq and has to not deal, but to connect with kids who have come from such disparate backgrounds?
I worked in the West Bank prior, so...
Or even in that experience as well, yeah.
So that experience was informative, and I've worked in other countries which are former war zones or, you know, places where women especially are trafficked or they're transit countries. So it's around. In that sense, I think you can go to any poorer part of the United States and see students that are struggling against odds that maybe if you've grown up in a middle-class family, you're not aware of. Like, it takes a certain income level to be able to provide your kids PSAT classes, mm-hmm. sophomore, junior year. I mean, all these things that we sort of take for granted if we've grown up in a middle-class living.
I have a 12-year-old. They're already talking about pre-classes for standardized testing to get into high school.
Right.
I mean, you get to a certain point where the suggestion is I have to go pay private lessons for him to get ready for that test.
Exactly. And if you don't have the money for it, that's a competitive advantage. So you have kids that perhaps are growing up in poorer neighborhoods, and they're using the same parts of their brain just for survival. But we don't always recognize that the development of those cognitive skills, I mean, they're actually problem solving as opposed to just memorizing and repeating and studying scholastically. So I don't think you need to go to somewhere as extreme as Northern Iraq, which is relatively safe right now and therefore not extreme, to see that kind of disadvantage to some people. I mean, we have it here.
When you are able to go back and forth to be able to live and teach in Northern Iraq and come back to Chicago, when you come back to Chicago, are we informed? Do we understand what's happening?
I would say not as much as I'd like generally people to be. The first question I get is, do you feel safe? So I was just in Naples and I was very violently and brutally mugged. That would never, ever, ever happen in Northern Iraq. It just wouldn't. Culturally, it wouldn't happen because it's much more community oriented, and because of Islam rooted in culture as well as in religion, you would never treat a stranger that way because you don't know if that stranger is Allah. The students there, students leave stuff everywhere and it always gets returned. So like you don't have theft, you don't have violence like that. I don't know how much you want to know about Kurdish politics, but there are two major political parties in the KRG in the northern region of Iraq. And one of the political party's leaders was accused of siphoning oil from the south for a long time and stealing a lot of money. And so the government in Baghdad cut off the payments for Iraq for its budget, which is 17% of the national budget. So all public service employees weren't paid full salaries for 4 years. My city, the opposition political party city, is 65% public service employees. I can't imagine.
Can you imagine
here when people wouldn't get paid or didn't get paid for that long? And it did break public school education. So high school went from, you know, half time to like a couple days a week to sometimes they didn't start the school year till mid-December and they didn't call the school year. They counted it. And then it stopped again in March. So the kids just didn't have contact hours.
Right.
you're not just losing the information, but you're losing the ability to sit and take in information. And yet they still managed to get it together and continue. At one point, when these public service employees weren't being paid, the police went on strike. The police went on strike in any major United States city. I would imagine there would be tons of looting, as you've seen when you have different catastrophes in cities and there's no power. It doesn't happen there. So there are differences, and I think that those are the things you don't realize when you hear about Iraq. And there are other issues. As being a foreign woman is a real drag. The patriarchy there is offensive. It's very limiting how I conduct my personal life outside of the university, just in terms of mobility, just the ability to walk at 6:30 at night to go run my errands after my work. I'm going to be followed in a car. Someone's going to try to grab me out a window. They're going to drive backwards and call out. And that's super annoying, but I never feel like my life is at stake.
You know, for you to be a novelist, a writer, to have had a life, and like you mentioned, a financial analyst, to be an actor, to work for a designer, I'm trying to figure out what got you to Northern Iraq. What is it about your temperament, about who you are, that for all the things that you have done in your life and the success that you've had, that this calling attracted you?
It was equal parts desperation and curiosity. I had come back to the United States in 2010, and I was not gainfully employed. I had come from Ukraine. And then I met the writer Jerry Van Dyke, who's written Captive. He was kidnapped by the Taliban and wrote a book about it. And then he went back and wrote a book called The Trade. He wanted the labyrinth of political kidnapping. He wanted to know how he had been freed. And he became a mentor, and he definitely encouraged me to go and give it a try. And I didn't start writing till 2010. So that part of my journey kind of happened at the same time, and I found Iraq to be very inspiring in a way, because the people you meet are crazy. I can remember sitting in this nightclub with the Minister of Christian Affairs and his cousin. And this guy comes in and they tell me that he's a hitman for this very prominent political family. And he looks like he's just walked off the set of The Sopranos. And there's like a gun check sign, as there are everywhere. And he like flashes open his double-breasted suit coat, and there's a gun in each pocket. So he's definitely got Wester political clout that he can bring his guns in. And the kicker is, he's in law school. He's in his third year of law school.
You need to be holding if you want to become a lawyer. Maybe that's the story. It seems like your life's about journeys. And you have, you know, you intimated in a way all the different places you've been in this life, and you continue to tell those stories. How important is having this kind of life where you're spread out and you're doing different things, different ways, to being a writer?
I'm definitely inspired by place. Moxie was my love letter to New York. I lived there for such a long time. It feels like home, and I missed it very much. I was living in Leipzig when I started it, and then I, you know, finished it in Northern Iraq. So it's, I came from the writer's studio. That's where I learned how to write. A great program. I highly recommend it. It's in New York, but they have online classes. They really taught me how to write. And they're big about the persona narrator. And they're also big about the emotional connection to your material. So for me, it's about having a connection to what I'm writing. You can see I have both sides of my face intact. But there is an emotional truth. I understand what it's like to be called ugly or to be considered ugly. And I can write from that emotional truth. So sometimes that truth comes from experience. And sometimes that comes from place. And sometimes it comes from empathy. And I think empathy is necessary to be a writer. So the rape in the military story, for people who don't know that, if you are raped by a military person or you're in the military, you don't get the usual system of justice. You don't make a complaint and it's investigated. You have to go through a chain of command that exists in the military, and often the person who is your perpetrator is your commanding officer chain of command, and so they can decide if the case will even be adjudicated or investigated. And at times, they've even overturned convictions within the military. It's very much a protect your own. Kirsten Gillibrand has tried to get an amendment to change this, to put it in a separate tribunal, because it exists already in the military, but has been unsuccessful. And this, no offense, gentlemen, white boys culture, protect your own, is so prevalent in places like the military and a lot of NGOs. And it allows for gender-based violence to continue. And so that is something that's very difficult for me as a female who has dealt with enough sexual misconduct in the workplace, as a business analyst, as a person teaching abroad, as an actor, that I have this emotional connection and I want to write about it. I want to fictionalize it. I feel like fiction should represent accurately the worlds we live in. But at the same time, it's not rooted in place. It's not always place, but it's more this emotional right. connection.
The novel is called Moxie. It's Alex Poppy's first novel, and it's out now. Alex, who is from Lombard, but now lives in northern Iraq, teaches American University in Iraq. Thank you so much for coming in. I know you did a short time to be back home, but then you're out and all over the world again. Alex, thanks so much for being my guest.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.